Ken Lundin has been a VP of sales twice over and has been running his own sales consulting practice as a solopreneur for many years with tremendous success, and recently rebranded as he and his team start to scale up. The new name is RevHeat, and I assure you, Ken brings the fire in this episode.
So Ken, I, as always, did a little bit of background and was poking around some of your interviews, and you've done a ton of podcast interviews, which is, people look up Ken Lundin or London?
Lundin. Right.
Lundin, thank you. Look him up, Ken, L-U-N-D-I-N, on listennotes.com, and you can just sit back and listen for hours and the great goodness that's going to come from this man. I've been friends with Ken on social media for years and have admired his business, his practice from afar. So it's perfectly timing here that I had to bring him to the show and learn from him and pick apart his practice and what makes him successful as a sales consultant. The first thing I want to ask you, Ken, is your transition into sales consulting. You were a VP of sales and then you moved into consulting. Can you talk about that inflection point for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. I think, well known, as we talked about, Derek, you did a post on LinkedIn just, you know, recently about the idea that like getting into sales consulting is typically not a straight line. You know, you don't, most of the time people aren't aspiring for it. There's an inflection point that happens in their life. So, I'd had some pretty good success at a fintech company. That came to an end. We grew a little faster than I think others wanted us to. So one of the things I did is, you know, we used to have this thing back in the day, you know, it's companies sub 500 million were the places where I'd play as a senior VP, EVP of sales. So I flew around the country. This was back in like 2016, interviewed and talked to private equity and talked to a bunch of other people. And two things happened during that process. One was I started thinking, man, would it be awesome if I could take what I've learned and what we've done in growing companies and actually serve more than one company?
Exactly.
And the second piece, which is the real piece no one wants to tell you about, is when you go through these interviews and you're talking to these companies and you're talking to CEOs and they basically come across like they hate their clients.
Oh, really?
That's a real bad place for like a, if you're a sales leader and you get any of that inkling from somebody in the C-suite, don't
what, is, what do you mean they hate their customers? Is it just that they are costing the business too much? They weren't profitable. They were,
yeah, just it's even at the size companies I was talking to, they were super internally focused. And if the client didn't see the world the way they saw the world, then they were stupid, or they weren't smart enough, or they, you know, it was just, or they were just a cog in the machine.
They don't get
as
it,
as opposed to the reason they exist.
So not buyer centric, not client centric, which I know is top of mind for you and all your engagements.
Yeah. It's one of those things, and you can see it. There's people listening to this podcast right now, and there'll be, you know, a million of them that'll listen in the future.
Oh, I hope.
And I bet you, if you're a sales leader, you know that if there's a rub between you and the rest of the executive team. Now, the interesting thing is there's usually that rub almost no matter what, to some extent, because the truth is a sales leader's goal in life is to break shit.
Oh, I love that. I mean, so there's a healthy amount of friction that you should expect then, right?
Yeah, because when you break shit and you're actually increasing sales and you're testing the systems and the operational efficiency of your company, everybody else is uncomfortable, but you're growing market share and you're rocking it. So it's really, really difficult, even if you're successful, if you're not, don't have some sort of that engagement level in the rest of the executive team, because I don't know what's happened. People take sales for granted, yet that's how we put food on the table. And so sales goes, yes, another deal. And service goes, yeah, more work. So, you know, it's just, it's an interesting dichotomy. So you got to watch for it.
So it's more, yeah, it sounds like there's the alignment or the misalignment that you're talking about. Because, you know, when I work with organizations, often one of the first things I'll do an assessment is, and then the first category is leadership buy-in. The second category is leadership alignment. Like, so right there at the top of the list is, are these leaders aligned? And if we bring a sales development team in, is there going to be friction that starts at the top? Because to your point, if they're not gelling, then that the culture, the rest of communication within the organization is all going to kind of stem from that, I think. So what you're saying is that there's a friction with upper executives that create some of these challenges, but then it's just the customers themselves that they're bringing on. There's a philosophy that leadership has that we have to tap into. So when you go to a company, either as a consultant or as a VP of sales, a salesperson, sniffing that out and understanding if they truly value and appreciate their clients. I mean, how do you test that if you're going to a company, I guess? I mean, as a consultant, you can do an assessment, ask people, go through that process. But if I'm a VP and I'm getting ready to join a company and I'm going to lead up their sales organization, how do I determine if the CEO has that, you know, wrong mindset?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is you probably don't start with a CEO. That's who you're interviewing with. If you're going to be a CRO, a VP of sales. And they all say, we're hiring you because the last guy didn't work out. Last gal didn't work out. And we really want to grow.
Right.
Okay. They all say that.
They didn't work out. Right.
Yeah. They didn't work out. They didn't do it. They weren't good enough. Has nothing to do with the hiring. Has nothing to do with the systems and process put behind it. Has nothing to do with the budget.
Environmental conditions. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing going on there. There's no accountability. So you have this going on at that level. And then on the other side of it, if I'm coming in and I'm going to say, how do I kind of sniff this out? I'm talking to the people who are the operational leads when they implement new products and services with their clients. Hey, tell me the last time you onboarded something. Tell me what that relationship with sales looks like. Hey, how do you feel when somebody brings it in? You have to go down a couple levels usually.
That's what I thought you'd
say. But you can get to what's happening.
Yeah. Because at that level, they're probably going to tell you what you want to hear. Everything's peachy. But then you get to insist on, I want to talk to more folks and really understand what the realities are.
Yeah. And I would say it's not that they're telling you what they want to hear. So let me not paint all CEOs because
there's an exception. I don't think anybody's
they're saying, a big piece of our business. So I don't want the CEOs to think I hate them. No, the CEOs, what happens is you get a little disconnected, right? You get monitor fatigue because the only thing you're seeing are the numbers and the things that are coming behind the organization. And so you've got this, if you've been somewhat successful or not, you've got this just kind of macro world view, and you may not realize the trouble that lays down in the actual depths of your organization where it's and sales and the rest of the culture are clashing.
Right.
Because you think, because you said it, it should be done. Truett Cathy, a quick story, Truett Cathy, who founded Chick-fil-A. And if you've ever been to a Chick-fil-A and you ask a question, Absolutely. You say anything, right? What's the one sentence they say?
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
That's all right. You're in California.
The food is great.
Okay. Yeah. I'm in Atlanta, so I know, right?
Okay.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. So Truett Cathy started that process of wanting to change the culture of how his people interacted.
Love that.
For 3 years.
But it took 3 years for that to really stick. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Put mandates in place. Put, discipline in place around it. Told all his managers to do it. And you know when it finally changed? When Truett Cathy himself started saying, my pleasure. Model the behavior you want. And that's how you get change in an organization.
Yeah, we're definitely going to capture that for the audiogram. That was a great lesson there. So leading by example and, living what you preach, that sort of thing is what you're saying, is where you really get people to move the needle for you and to adopt the practices that you're trying to implement.
Yeah. And I take that one step forward because I think lead by example is
overused,
misconstrued, right? Everybody can feel like they're leading by example. The truth is, if I tell you to model the behavior you expect, man, think about the teeth that has. So let's see. So I want you to be on time for meetings, but I'm never on time for meetings. I want you to end meetings on time, but I never end meetings on time. I want you to believe that our calendared events are important, but I keep canceling the one-on-ones with you.
I got one. I want you to keep your CRM updated, but when I engage with clients and partners, I don't update it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So see that, just think about how that just goes through the entire organization.
Right.
So yeah, the model of the behavior is one of the key tenets we talk about if you're going to get an impact from a managerial or leadership level.
Thank you. So you, let's go back to your practice. You, when you jumped into consulting after being a VP of sales and learning those lessons, now you've ran Ken Lundin's and Associates for a period of time, and now you're in the process or have made a change, a pivot, if you will. Talk about that. I think you're in a place where you're trying to scale, which is a big point for those that are consulting. There's usually that, do I want to leave this as a lifestyle business? It's kind of like what I've done as an independent consultant most of the time. Or do I want to scale this out, hire people, and, you know, see where we can go. Talk about that, this inflection point that you're in right now and how you're making that transition.
Yeah, it's interesting and probably way too much for this show, so I'll keep it brief. Ken Lundin Associates, the interesting thing about that is one of the things that I missed most in that process, I was an individual consultant, carried a number of clients, made a great living, traveled when I wanted to, but it was lonely, man. You laugh because
you miss
true.
No, you miss working on a team. Your client, yeah. I mean, you're an extension of teams, and so by way of that, you're sort of on a team, but yeah, I understand. Go ahead.
Yeah, so this was, and this being my second business venture, the first one, I got caught up in the recession, led to bankruptcy in 11, you know, really got kicked in the teeth.
Thanks for sharing.
But with this particular kind of change, I said, okay, who can we best serve and how can we best serve them? So we've been in the process and actually completed the process about 6 months ago to rebrand to RevHeat. And so RevHeat is just a fantastic way for us to engage with our clients. And so we're in a position now where, from a scaling perspective, we're looking at different patterns and models of how we're bringing out our consultants, how we're making sure they're delivering the outcomes that we want them to. And then in addition, really arming consultants with how to do the business of consulting, because I think this may resonate with you.
Yep.
There are two things going on in consulting. There's the business of consulting and there's consulting the work. Most consultants think consulting the work is where the money is.
The client work, the work streams. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's where you get paid. That's not how you create a lifelong income stream. The business of consulting is super important. So when we talk about it, we've got a track that we use for a training track for our consultants that we're putting in place where they'll actually have one full training load that's all about the business of consulting. So yeah, doing a lot of stuff. I don't know if that answered the question directly.
It's an important piece. As you scale your business and you look to bring consultants on, which is part of what we're talking about, you have a program that onboards them and teaches them more about running the business and delivering the work. So one of the reasons I jumped into doing this podcast was to get better. And I say this all often in my interviews, is this isn't just about lead gen or brand building. This is about me talking to people like you and understanding what's working, what's not, not just in the way of revenue creation, but also in the way of just running a consulting practice and being a better consultant, right? So what you're talking about is huge. There are consultants out there who, like myself, I kind of just jumped into it. I knew I had a skill set that was applicable, could help people. I did some online stuff, but I hadn't gone through any, formal training, So when I jumped into consulting, it was just, my people knew who I was, they knew what I was good at, and I had a certain skill set. But the business of consulting is something I had to learn on the fly.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that holds people back. I made, just by comparison, I made $33,000 the first 9 months as a consultant.
Good number. It's my favorite number, but that's not enough money, I'm sure.
So, you got to be in this thing. And so one of the things that, I was thinking about, and I had a good friend, Ron L. Richards, who was talking to me. He goes, Ken, it's a lot more important than you think it is, having this business consulting plus the actual resources and things behind the scaling of the business. Because quite frankly, how many people go into consulting who fail? The stakes are substantially higher. And so, yeah, we're looking at all of this quite primarily through the lens of being client-centric. How do we deliver the best outcomes in the world for our clients?
Very good. Now, are you funding this yourself or is this bootstrapped?
All self-funded, man. Wow. All self-funded. Wow. So, that's the other interesting part about scaling. If nobody's told you this, the interesting thing about scaling is this. You get to where you're making a comfortable living and then you take a pay cut.
Right. That's
because you're putting it all back into the business. And it's really, it's educated guesses. It's almost smart bets.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. But betting on yourself and betting on your vision. Yeah.
But you notice I said guess and bet. Right. So I'm betting on myself. My fiance believes me, but she's the show me state, and I'm the optimist. So
Well, that's a good balance. That's a good balance. Yeah. Well, all money in, as they say, you know, you got to put it back in to see what you can get out. I admire that because that's a scary place to be in. You know, it could be a scary place to be in, but you've done really well in your practice. You have a good ecosystem around you, it sounds like, with other advisors and experts, along with, you know, good clients that you like, right?
We love our clients. That's another thing, because I know this is the sales consultant show, and so there'll be consultants listening, and there could be potential companies listening. But from a consultant perspective, I'm going to give you one piece of advice that if you ignore this, just know you'll be miserable. A bad client fit is always a bad client fit. There is not a situation in the world where if somebody needs something done that you're not capable of or experienced in, there's not something in the world where if you get all the tingles and the spider senses go off that, man, they aren't going to lean into this. There is almost no amount of money in the world that's worth taking that because of the reputation, the time, and the stress.
I have heard that a couple times, but not said that way. Let me understand this though. What makes a bad client for you? If, you know, I'm sure you've had to fire clients maybe at times where it's like, hey, this, you know, we've reached the end of this, it's not working out. I've talked to other consultants on the show or trainers, and they've shared stories of, hey, you know, one of the best days in their career was when their longest top customer fired them, you know? And so it doesn't always work out. It's the reality of it. You know, not every engagement is ideal, but in your mind, what would make a bad client for a sales consultant?
I think the number one thing is whether or not they have the ability to change. And the issue becomes you have to be able to look at their mindset, and then you also have to be able to look at their skill set. Mm. And so we have found that as we go up in organizations and get multi-layered sales organizations from CRO to VP to, you know, to sales manager to individual contributor, there's more juice in getting the change at the levels that'll influence the individual contributors or the sellers. Mm-hmm. But that would be the number one thing, because people hire a consultant for exactly one thing, to change what's going on in their organization. So that would be the one thing that I would say for every consultant. For us, it's people who won't slow down and hit our auditing phase first. We have a
rush to grow. They want to skip to the third step, and we got to be pragmatic about this to make sure we don't step on landmines and so forth.
Yeah. If you don't go through the auditing stage with us, it's all a guess. It's just a swag, man. We're out there just guessing what to do next, what to train the team on. Do you have systems and processes in place to support the team? So for us, it's anybody who goes, oh, I can't wait 30 days. Well, you've waited 6 months to do anything so far. You know, what if we can set this thing correctly so that we actually paint a roadmap for the next 52 weeks? So there are two things: the ability to change, and the second thing for us is people who have unrealistic expectations and don't understand the value of getting a diagnosis of the root causes rather than just treating the symptoms.
Love that. Thank you. And that triggers another question. At what point typically do clients bring you in to help them with? And you have two lines of service primarily. I know you do a lot of different things. Consulting, which could be a lot of different areas, and training specifically. But at what point do your clients usually bring you in? What's that inflection point? What does that climate look like? What situations are they facing? This might help anybody who's maybe considering reaching out to a consultant or reaching out to Refi. Yeah.
I think there are two ways. There's three ways. The way that most do it is the shit's against the wall and their back's against the wall. They've been in the job a little longer. They haven't had the budget to do things. And then all of a sudden, everybody gets aligned around the idea that a turnaround needs to happen. That's one way. That was where my very first client was in a 2.5-year decline on the verge of bankruptcy when we got to them. They're still a client today, and they've grown 500%.
Wow.
The second kind are growth accelerated companies who, you know, we've worked with three, been fortunate enough to work with three unicorns. And they're people who are forward looking, and they're like, I have to continue to prepare my team for 6 months, 12 months down the road. So I need to continue to enhance the skill sets, the processes, and the systems that we have. There's less of those because, you know, even in marketing, we know people like to read the negative headlines instead of the positive headlines.
Yeah, there's more laggards than early adopters out there. And that sounds like what you, the proactive, forward thinking, that's the minority. Yeah,
I'd agree. Yeah, and then the super sweet spot is somebody who says, huh, our sellers are going to have to be better over the next 12 months than they were 12 months ago, which there's no time like now that that's true with the uncertainties in the economy, just to get the same amount of sales. So we need to be able to find a way to efficiently move our sellers and their skill sets and their knowledge forward. And that's that middle group is the sweet spot of how do you hire a consultant at the right time without letting it go too long in the tooth where you, the head of sales, your job is in jeopardy.
Yeah, that's but that sounds like a tough, especially the budget's impact. It's, you know, and consultants aren't cheap often, right? So it's definitely one of those things. And I think what I find is there's those that have a history of leveraging consultants and have had good experience and, you know, understand that model and embrace it. And then I find that there's philosophically leaders that are just against bringing outsiders in, and outsiders I use purposely, third parties. Do you see that as well, where there's like a philosophical belief or lack thereof in leveraging, you know, consultants, advisors, third parties to help with training and these things?
Yeah, I was trying to hold back like this smile, because as you're talking about that, I remember a conversation that I had with one of our clients, who's the chief revenue officer named Dave Jimenez at Project 202. And he said, look, people you sell, we're tough. Because CROs, CSOs, VPs of sales, we are arrogant as hell. And we think we know everything.
What do we need and a you know consultant what? For? Yeah.
You might. But you might be asking the wrong questions too. And so, yeah, I certainly see that rub where you've got people who have done it well and not. So there's one, it's the, we have this kind of level of, you had to have some success in your career in order to ascend to lead a sales team.
Right.
So congratulations, and that's great. You know, but on the other hand, we also have an industry problem, because the sales training and consulting industry is freaking broken.
Tell me more.
It's not set up the way it's supposed to be. We would never teach our clients to sell the way we sell. I mean, for the most part, you know what we say? We say, hey, Derek, what do you need? Cool, we can do that. That's not how we teach B2B sellers to sell. We teach them to figure out what the latent pain is, to go deep in it, to understand it, to be prescriptive, to be able to actually help them understand what's going, to see around corners that they can't see around today. We deliver sales training courses because a VP of sales calls up and says, I need them to be better closers. No, you don't. You need them to be better at value development, which starts in the discovery call.
Exactly.
So we continue to just permeate this selling stuff just because people will buy it. And there's been they spent over $70 billion last year on sales training. And this much of it was focused on where is your team today versus where they need to go, and let's build a custom curriculum.
Well, actually, I want to know, when you go in and you do a training, I know training usually is like a one-time thing, but you probably stay on to help, I'd imagine. So you see the how they're effective at deploying the training and adopting it, or how maybe they're not so effective. That's so. One question I always like to ask folks like yourself is, what blocks clients from getting value from your engagements? When you just, what you just talked about, I think, is a perfect setup. So you've consulted, you've training, you're working with this client. What are the characteristics, the attributes on the client side that prevents them from really taking what you're bringing to them and moving the needle?
If I were to say that one thing, because I've said three things about everything else, I'll say one thing this time.
I like the number three. Three is a good number.
I know. Three things about three things is a great way to talk. The one thing that gets in the way is the lack of attention to detail around changing the behaviors of your sales management.
Sales management, okay. Mm-hmm.
That middle layer is the most important. We talked about it earlier. If they can't model the behavior that this is important and that these skills are going to be tested, and if they don't inspect what they expect, to use an old cliche.
No, I love that. I still use that to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then that will be the reason that you won't get the impact. And look, we're really, really, really honest with our clients about it, because, and when we audit a company, we tell you how much more your team can sell in a certain time frame if you do a certain thing. So when we get where that thing's being blocked, we get into it and we start talking about it.
Because you can put dollars to it and say, hey, look, there's an adoption issue here, and this is what the effect of that is going to be. So it's not just an anecdote anymore.
Correct. Yeah, we tie it. It's one of the things we do a little different is we'll tie the audit in, right? To actually, hey, here's what you need to do and why. Because sales leaders today, I mean, part of it, right? So here's the other problem with hiring. Sales consultants generally come in, they sell a product instead of a service. They sell a product instead of ROI. The VP of sales leader, CRO, has to go to the CEO and say, hey, I want, you know, give me $100,000 for this thing. And they say, well, what will it do? And he says, well, I think it'll make them better. You know, nowadays when the CFO is effectively the CEO in economically uncertain times, that doesn't work.
Yep.
So that's why we always try to lead. Hey, let's lead with, do we need to fix the sales team? And then from there, they have the ability to take that and go, hey, we can see another 50 million if we do these things.
Right. And it's all. And so do you do that pre-engagement where you're putting some of those numbers to paper so they can see what the ROI could potentially be through your engagement?
Yes, we do that before any long-term engagement. And then the other thing that leads to that is that because you have a plan, right? Think about this, you know, sales consultants, you've talked to a lot of them. Most of them don't have an actual like real scope of work like you'd see in our real professional services, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's this two-page thing. Hey, we'll come in and do some stuff. But when you get a real scope of work, which says we've got to accomplish these 10 things over the course of the next 52 weeks, because we can get to this number over the course of the next 24 months, that starts to move some people. That starts to motivate them, which goes back to the idea of, now that I have a senior sales leader who's talking to his managers, hey, no, guys, we've got to make some changes because this is how we're going to become more effective.
Well, if you don't mind sharing, and you don't have to tell us the exact amounts, but how do you structure an engagement then? Do you do it value-based? Do you do it on outcomes? When I do it, I'm still doing hourly, full confession. not everybody. So far, I'm going to ask this question. No one's doing that. So I feel like I need to change that about my practice. So what are you guys doing in terms of structuring engagement? And again, don't give it to us specifics, that you can let them contact you to find that out.
Yeah, we have two, say, purchases that happen, two SOWs that happen with a company. First is the audit. It's 30 to 45 days. And I'll tell you right now, that's about $500 a salesperson. It's the most smoking amount of information you'll ever, ever see on your people, because it's compared to a couple million others. So that's one. And the second base.
Hit that though. A couple million others. When we did prep, you'd walk me through this. It's just a couple million others. Like, you have the talk about who you're comparing it to when you do this audit. I think you mentioned it a few times and it sounds like a really important step.
Yeah. So we have a partner that we work with, but we have a auditing process that looks at people and skills, processes and systems, your training development plans. And within that, we've had over 2.5 million people from all across the globe, 33,000 companies, 200 plus industries go through it.
Wow.
So we can actually compare, hey, how is your team versus the broader average of these other 33,000 companies? Oh, and how do they compare within your industry? So, you know, because why is that important? Because in economically uncertain times, let's grow market share. Don't necessarily talk, you got to stay in tune with the market, because you know, the market share is what matters, because that actually you hold, according to a study by Bain, and then you accelerate out of the uncertainty. So that's what we work on. And it's
thank you for
clarifying. Killer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the $500 per salesperson for the audit. But when you zoom out and you think about the underpinning of your pricing structure,
mm-hmm.
Is it based on the value? Because now that you can articulate this ROI, and you're factoring all that in, are you tying your fees to those outcomes? Are you not being paid unless those outcomes happen? Is there a guarantee? Yeah. If I'm asking too much,
No, you're right. Yeah. We can talk about some of it, and I'll avoid some of it. How's that?
There you go. Thank you.
So there's a guarantee on the audit.
Okay.
It's not actionable. It's 100% money back guarantee. And that's the first engagement with us. And it's the small one. Second is because we have we know the exact scope of the changes that need to be made across process, systems, training, development, people skills, hiring, etc. Because we know the exact scope, we have the exact steps laid out, and they're applied to the actual upside could be from a sales or a margin perspective. Sure, we have a kind of a price list, but yeah, typically more it's about the value that we can provide. Because, you know, I really look at this and I say, at the end of the day, I want to make sure that every single person, that every single company we work with feels like they can get a minimum of 20-1 on their investment.
Got it.
And so that's one of the things that we dial into.
That's your North Star, in fact, getting this, putting this together.
And it's not, it's okay. Usually somewhere between 20 and say 30. 20 and 35, but yeah, the 20 is kind of the baseline of, I'm saying, yeah, if you're going to invest 100,000, I want you to be able to take another 2 million home.
Wow. There you go. I love that. Yeah. Cause going back to the SOW in all transparency, you know, I write out the tasks and the deliverables, and maybe when those deliverables will be delivered, but the thing that underpins it typically is a bucket of hours or monthly hours, and we just kind of bill against those hours. But the SOW dictates the work that's going to be done, and I haven't been able to figure out how to make a transition to something like what you're talking about. Not just because I want to, you know, charge more, make more money, but I want to make sure that I'm staying in line with the market, like you were talking about, and. You know, so trying to articulate a model like that, this is what you shared, I think is massively helpful for not just people who are looking at partnering with a consultant or an advisor like yourself, but folks like me who are trying to, you know, be in line with the market, if you will. Talk to me about the alpha sales roadmap. That's a very, I'm going to switch gears here on you. Yep. The very popular framework that you've used in a lot of your engagements. Right. And so we've been going for a while, but I'm really eager to understand this framework more. Sales Alpha Roadmap, go. What is that and how does it work within an organization?
Yeah, perfect. So it has essentially three stages. We've talked about one a few times, which is audit. Second stage is advancing, and the third stage is accelerating. And in doing so, we have three buckets. It's three things about three things, like we spoke about. Mm-hmm. So we have three buckets that we primarily focus on within each of those tiers.
Okay.
So auditing sets the place for what we're doing. Advancing is putting the stuff in that we can make the biggest impact on the earliest. And then accelerating is the stuff that has to happen that takes a little more time, changing sales processes, systems, those types of things. And so the Sales Alpha Roadmap is the way that we actually structure our engagements to make sure that we can provide value and outcomes for our clients. Because, you know, it's like going to a doctor. If you don't go to the doctor, like I walk in the doctor, I say, oh, my back hurts, you know, oh, and can you give me a shot? And then he says, walk to the door. And then he sees that I'm hobbling on my right leg. Well, guess what? The root cause is my right leg, not my back. And too often, what people can't tell about their sales teams and their sales organizations prior to the Sales Alpha Roadmap is why things are happening. Mm-hmm. They can tell you what, I'm missing a number, I'm making a number, they're not dialing enough, they are dialing enough. But what we seek to understand when we go through the audit, advancing, and accelerating is we seek to cure the why, because we want to talk about behaviors, mindsets, skill sets. And so we will be able to train on those things and work on those things with clients.
Love it. Yeah, that's sounds, and I'm sure it's highly comprehensive as well, all those buckets. Because if we were going to like the accelerate pillar, there's probably a lot that happens in that phase and so forth, right? So. And are you ever straddling those phases? I would imagine. I know with my framework, when I go from design to hiring within a sales development implementation, I usually just design in enough to start the hiring phase. But while we're hiring, we're still working on the design phase and the things that we, that way we can get the speed. Are you overlapping that way often?
Yeah, we have to, because business is messy. So, right. You know, anyone who tells you it's not, you've got to be able to walk and chew gum. And so, we are able to do that because we have one client as an example we're working on right now. It's about 60 sellers, $150 million in sales. And the first 4 months of the engagement, we launched sales training for their team. We launched sales training for their management. We reset their sales processes, which are now being updated through Salesforce. And then we also have installed a new recruiting and hiring process that we call the STAR program, which is incredibly successful. So, you know, those things are all overlapping because I guess our goal, you know, my goal is to make an impact in the first 90 days so that you don't second guess yourself for the next 9 months we're in your business.
Right, right, right. You got to show those early wins.
Yeah.
Right. Well, as we turn the corner here and head home, I got a couple questions for you. A, how do you get better? You're helping people get better all day, every day with training and consulting. What are your inputs for you to improve as a consultant, stay fresh, and so that the methods and the techniques that you're teaching and advising on are the freshest?
Probably a couple things. I'll tell you that the way that question lends itself is to say, Ken, would you answer this based upon the sales consulting, sales training, sales stuff resources?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I would tell you that's not where most of it comes from. You know, most of it comes from, I've got an Audible account that I overuse.
There you go.
Right. And I overuse.
So what are you listening to right now? What book are you listening to right now? If you turned it on right now, what would you be listening to?
The Gap and the Gain.
The Gap and the Gain. Okay.
Yeah. It's a really great book.
Okay.
It's The Gap and the Gain. So I'll give you the quick summary for your readers. What I like about it is this. It basically shows you why if you're a successful or aggressive person, why you're miserable every time you hit your goal is because you move the goalpost to compare yourself to the ideal state instead of to look back and compare yourself to the progress that you made.
Ooh, yes.
So it's pretty dynamite. So
don't look at how far you have to go. Look at how far you've come.
Yes.
I love that. Okay.
Yeah, because if you're an entrepreneur like me, I've got this end state and we've talked about it. I mean, you know, my end state is something that I've never heard anybody else in our business talk to. But if I get to each one of my milestones and then I keep comparing it to the ideal state instead of how far I've come, you know, and I found out it you do it to your kids too, right? Got a kid who's an athlete. They just, you know, they hit a triple and you're like, yeah, but you know, if you'd have just kept that elbow inside,
you're right, that could have been over the fence.
Exactly. Yeah. So avid reader.
Okay.
Big gym guy. Cause I believe the body follows the mind follows the body.
Amen. Right there with you.
So big fitness guy from that perspective. And then I've got a group of three or four kind of other people who are experiencing this world in a different way. So I don't want to say they're better or they're worse or I'm better or I'm worse. We just all have a different set of experiences because even though we all serve the sales community and companies, we aren't doing it in the same manner. And okay. So we get to really have these honest conversations and those are the ways that we're able to stay better. And then being innately curious. I'm all over AI, all over the stuff. And that's just stuff where you spend hours on research, you know.
You just play with really ChatGPT yet?
Yeah, use it all the time for ideation.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm slacking. I need to get on it.
It saves me conservatively 4 to 5 hours a week.
Watch out now. All right. So are you going to use Bing's version with a built-in or I'm just spitballing here with
on a random note. Yeah. I have no idea because that's more search. So yeah. It's definitely one of the first draws of ChatGPT was the fact it would actually give you an answer instead of sending you onto a page with 422 websites that you had to dig through.
Right.
So I would hope Bing is inherently better now, but I didn't even know Bing was still around. So
well, that's where it is. That's right. You know, that's
yeah. I saw Microsoft come out with that, but I was like, didn't you guys sunset that?
Well, someone literally, I saw a post that literally said that Bing is making a comeback and just laughed. Anyways,
next thing you know, AOL will be using it and AOL.com and dial up.
All right. Last question. I told you I was going to tell you what this one was going to be, and it's not that big of a zinger, but. And maybe I haven't seen it, but where's the Ken Lending book?
It's a great question. We've been thinking about it and it's in here, but just the sheer amount of workload right now, as we move in and we launch our new learning management system and the other things that we're doing. I've got a book in here.
All right. It's up for somewhere,
but I gotta prioritize. And, I appreciate the question, but yes,
absolutely. I would cop that right away. a pre-order for sure.
Perfect. I got one sold.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure there's someone else here listening that would as well. You're launching your training content now into a learning management system, LMS. So that's a major initiative for you right now. Before we tell people where to find you, talk about that and, you know, whatever else Rev heats up to that's hot and next.
Perfect. The learning management system and the platform that we're using, we've gone to because we need to be able to connect with people wherever they are. So not only will it be an LMS, but we'll have a privately branded app for the RevHeat Academy that people will be able to download and be able to put it on any device they want. We've moved into the best practices and best in breed because as expensive as it is, it's super, super important that we make outcomes for people, that we help, you know, salespeople change their lives, that we help companies. You know, I've got countless stories of the salesperson that went from $65,000 a year to $600,000. And it's not just the cash, it's the what it did for them. They got to move into a better neighborhood, into a better school district.
Start a family. Yeah.
Got to decide if their spouse wanted to take time down. And so I found that with this digital age, there are people doing that learning management system. But the other important point, the reason that we're doing it is traditional sales training. I mentioned the industry is broken. There's something called the Effingham forgetting curve, which says you forget 77% of what you learn in 6 days. And we do quarterly trainings in this industry. So what does that do? That's why you've had a bad experience with sales training. So what we do is we start with that process and then we say, hey, we're going to do some micro learnings. We're going to do asynchronous, instructor-led, in order to let you try something for a couple of weeks before we teach you the next concept. Because our goal is to make change and get people to stick. And so this will be a massive.
Not just get them to memorize some stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you can have some good interaction.
Right.
And going back quarterly was a great business model for me years ago, right? You know, I got paid, but you had to bring me back because your people didn't get better. So, yeah. So we're leaning into that really, really hard because we absolutely are looking for ways to help B2B sellers and sales organizations get better.
Absolutely. Well, good luck in that endeavor. I know that's definitely a lot of work and a lot of investment. Where should people go to find you if they want to connect, learn more, or maybe set up an audit?
Yeah, perfect. So revheat.com is always a great place to go. R-E-V as in revenue. So that's first. Second is what I'd really, really love is come connect with me or follow me on LinkedIn. Look for me there. KG Lundeen is the tag on it. Look for me there. And then when you do that, connect with me and put in the show notes that you heard Derek and I talking today. Whether that's just you want to connect or that's whether you want somebody to bounce something off and have a free strategy session for 30 minutes, I'm cool with either. So would love to see that though. And I think those are the two best places you can get to us.
You've been listening to the Sales Consultant Podcast. If you enjoyed the interview and would like to support the show, please be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and or on Spotify. Please also consider following our LinkedIn page. If you're an industry expert or if you know an industry expert that should be on the show, message us on LinkedIn at the Sales Consultant Podcast.